Coming up next on KSEO, it's hour number one of the Dr. Future Show.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSEO presents the Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Why do we never get an answer?
Happy Tuesday, everyone. Beautiful day out there in Santa Cruz today. I feel like it's summer already, except for these allergies I'm getting. Other than that,
I feel so sad for you.
Well, we all have something to deal with, don't we?
Absolutely. But you'd think with all of the advances in medicine that allergies would be part of the past.
You would think.
And yet here they are plaguing you today.
I know. It gets me thinking deeply about what this all means.
Yeah, I bet. I bet. As a very advanced human, you're still battling the plants.
Yeah, I guess. And one of my favorite ones, too. I think I'm allergic to redwood pollen.
Oh, well, imagine. Yeah. Do you think the redwoods think they're allergic to you?
I hope not. Hope they don't take offense that I've used them for firewood.
Right. Oh, maybe that's it.
You think?
Well, a lot of people are suffering from smoke inhalation. That's a fact.
Well, the good news is that lately we haven't had to use any, with this warm weather.
That's true. It has really been a shift in the seasons, right? I think I heard Dave Michaels talking about his sincere belief in the fact that the seasons have shifted, that we're no longer living in the same world of weather that we were.
Well,
say a few decades ago.
Anecdotal evidence. You have to look at the bigger picture.
Yep, definitely.
Yep. Anyway, there are shifts going on. There's an interesting shift with the FCC this week.
Yeah, what's
the federal communication shifting?
What is the FCC got to do with reality?
They've changed the definition of broadband.
Okay, broadband, the data channels that bring us all our network and cellular phone calls and. No, I guess not our cellular phone calls, but our data networks.
Yeah, your data network. You have LTE on your smartphones and stuff like that. You have DSL at home or Comcast cable or one of these connections.
I'll tell you where I don't have broadband is right here in the talk studio.
Yeah, you feel like you're on a dial-up?
My iPad has been stuck just with the little, wait spinning dial for the whole show. I don't think I'm going to be able to look at any of the articles with you today.
Okay, well, I'll do my best to carry the show then.
Okay.
The FCC...
I'll just give you my unedited comments on the fly.
That's always good.
No data.
They've changed the definition so that it used to be that the minimum broadband download speeds were like 4 megabits per second. Mm-hmm. And Netflix will work on it and that sort of thing. Well, the new definition of minimum broadband download speeds is 25 megabits per second. 25 from 4. Significant upgrade.
What does this mean to the average data user?
That means what we considered fast is now normal.
Okay.
All right. So we've gone from 4 megabits to 25 megabits is what we considered a broadband connection.
I see. So we're about 8 times let's see.
And the minimum uploads.
6 times faster.
Yeah, that's the download speed. And the minimum upload would be from 1 megabit to 3 megabits.
Okay.
So still megabits up is still low. But that effectively triples the number of U.S. households that don't have broadband access. Currently, according to the stats here, 6.3% of U.S. households don't have access to broadband under the previous 4 megabits down, 1 megabits up threshold.
Okay, so let me get it straight here. So 94% of the households in America do have that little 4 megabit
Yeah,
bandwidth
most people
access.
Have the 4 megabits down.
But now, that's not considered broadband. That's sort of just like a straw sipping data on the internet, but everybody else can pour water.
We're 80% of Americans can access 25.3. That's the new standard.
Okay. So what are you going to do with all that broadband access?
Well, I'm going to do virtual reality. I'm going to do, you know, I'm going to do multiple channels at once. I'm going to do high definition Skype. I'm going to do stereo audio productions of my own. You know, I'll get into Dr. Future video.
Really? That's enough to send video?
Stuff like that. Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. It'll be connected living rooms. You know, we'll be able to do all kinds of cool stuff in the house with this type of bandwidth. Stuff we don't even realize yet. It's like when we went up to four. I mean, when we went up to four megs down back in, and one meg up back in 04, I guess, the last time the standards were upgraded seriously. That's when Skype came in. That's when voice over IP started to happen. That's when we began to get modern day communications infrastructure.
So we went from text to audio. Now we're going from audio to visual.
Well, yeah, we do have visual, but it'll be better visual.
It'll be better, yeah. Like HD.
Yeah, at the very least. Maybe 3D, who knows? You know, we'll think up new stuff.
Okay.
That's heartening. Yeah, you know, the government does make some progress in some areas. At least they're passing the standard for us to play with there.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. All right, well, more broadband. Are we going to see it? I mean, the FCC has now made their decree. Mm. When does it affect us in a way that we can recognize?
I think you'll start to see it. You'll start to see the overall numbers increasing, you know, when you order broadband. It'll constantly get better. Right now you have the silver, platinum, it's kind of like the healthcare plans.
You're talking about our etheric network plans?
Yeah. Uh-huh. You know, and so the minimums will increase. You'll see that across the board, I think.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Well. Okay, so that's interesting. And another first was this year the Super Bowl was the first Super Bowl lit by LEDs.
Very interesting. I wonder how many people were aware of that.
I don't know, but they saved 75% on their power bill.
Oh, boy. I wonder if the ticket prices are going to go down.
No. No, but this year, the stadium swapped out 780 metal halide fixtures for 312 LED fixtures.
Oh, boy. All right.
I heard that the tickets
Monahan
for the Super Bowl were $6,000 to $8,000 each for the bad seats.
For the bad seats. Give me my 3D virtual experience, please.
I've never heard of that. I got in Super Bowl 10 for $10.
Oh, you did, eh?
Yeah.
Well, welcome to the show, John.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you watch the game?
That was actually one of the best Super Bowls I ever saw, especially when the Patriots got lucky against the Seattle Seahawks at the very last play of the game.
Yeah. Are you a Seahawks fan?
You know, it was Seattle's always gotten lucky at the super lucky. This time they got unlucky.
Oh, yeah.
Which is fine with me.
Uh-huh. So you are a Patriot.
Yes. I lived in at least 9 years in New England, and I lived in Boston and Cambridge and Middleborough. And yeah. What the heck? It's about time I root for the Patriots.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
All right. Hey, listen, let's go to a break, and then we're going to come back with more headlines on the Dr. Future Show. Stay tuned.
Okay, welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. Now, there's interesting news from the UK today. The UK has moved towards making babies from DNA of three people.
Oh, boy. Okay. A new kind of triplets, huh? Three parents instead of three babies.
It's making a more disease-free baby.
This is really strange news.
Britain moved Tuesday toward allowing scientists to create humans from the DNA of three people.
Okay.
Now, according to this piece from Yahoo News, the technology aims to liberate future generations from inherited diseases, but critics say it crosses a fundamental scientific boundary and could lead to designer babies. And they voted in the Commons 382 to 178 in favor of legislation to license these experiments. If
so approved, the Britons want designer babies?
Well, if it's approved by the House of Lords, it will become the world's first nation to allow genetic modifications in human embryos.
Oh, boy, I guess they're going to get the clone tourist trade.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
It's considered a bold step, but an informed one.
Okay, so let's explain what's going on
well,
here.
Well, the technology is completely different from that used to create genetically modified foods, for starters.
Okay, so these are GMHs. These are genetically modified humans, not genetically modified organisms.
Genetically modified foods.
Except I wonder if the GMHs will eat GMOs.
Well, the one similarity is that the changes made to embryos will be passed on to future generations, where we don't know what might happen. But this was specifically drafted to grant permission only to certain specified techniques and diseases.
Okay. Like what? What kind of diseases qualify for this cloning procedure where three parents become one egg?
Well, the genetic effects create muscular dystrophy, heart, kidney, and liver failure, and severe muscle weaknesses. They remove the nucleus of the DNA from the egg of the prospective mother and insert it into a donor egg from which the nucleus DNA has been removed, and the resulting embryo would have the nucleus DNA from its parents. But the difference is that the mitochondrial DNA is from the donor.
That is going to screw up 23andMe. let me get it straight here. So the normal genetic blend that creates the child still comes from the mom and the dad.
99% of the DNA is still from the two parents.
But that little fertilized nucleus,
a tiny fraction comes from the donor egg,
is put into a new surrogate egg that has its own nucleus removed, and it just has a mitochondria from a new
mitochondrial
person.
DNA. Yeah, which is the batteries of the cell.
And I wonder, does it have to be women? Can it be men?
It says that the law would give women with mitochondrial disease the opportunity to have children without passing on devastating genetic disorders.
Right.
Okay, so it's for women.
It's for women who have a mitochondrial disease, and it's kind of like cellular surrogates.
Well, could I mention something I learned about mitochondrial DNA?
What's that?
Sure.
It's passed from mother to mother, the history of the human race. And they've found out that the entire human race is descended from one African mother. Mm-hmm. By learning the history of the human race through the mitochondrial DNA. With so there you go. Theory. We're all Africans.
The Eve theory.
Yeah, well, that's true. You go back far enough, we all come from the same original stock. And in fact, we just saw a documentary last night on different kinds of psychedelics and
Netflix.
On Netflix, right. And they were interviewing some rainforest natives. I don't know if it was the Pachamama people, but basically the rainforest natives consider all humans to be the children of plants. So, you know, if you keep going further and further back, you get to primordial soup, right?
Yeah. Well, I think part of what that documentary showed was that the psychedelic experience takes you into the commonness of humanity, the commonality of being human. Mm-hmm. And it goes deeper than the programming of, you know, what nation state you are or what race you are, and gets into more commonalities, which is important if we're going to get past these commonalities that create war between us all the time.
Yeah. You know,
culture is great until it isn't.
Well, when you start realizing that that plants are parents of animals, you know, it seems like it's really true that all fighting, all violence is really just civil rivalry, right? It's happening at the level of people who should be able to get along.
Yeah, battle over resources and things that are no longer as necessary.
Trying to take food from your brothers and sisters starts right there.
And violence and domination and intimidation. I mean, these are really pathologies in a civilized world. But when you reduce people to an uncivilized existence, then it becomes about domination to survive.
Yeah, the low on Maslow's hierarchy of needs, as they say, you know. Yeah. It's interesting that Silicon Valley now is becoming one of the world headquarters in robotics. And robotics is rapidly increasing in intelligence. And they are kind of like our children in a way, too. And what values do we pass on to our robots? Now, Bill Gates has come out on this whole AI intelligence debate. Uh-huh. You know, a lot of people have been worried about artificial intelligence possibly wiping out humanity. And Bill Gates is the latest to jump on that bandwagon. Stephen Hawking, Elon Musk, and Bill Gates now.
What bits of wisdom does he have to offer to the debate?
Well, at a Red Edit event, he was asked how he felt about the potential dangers of AI. And he said that he's definitely worried. He says, quote, "I am in the camp that is concerned about superintelligence. First, the machines will do a lot of jobs for us and not be super intelligent, kind of like they are now. That should be positive if we manage it well. A few decades from now, though, the intelligence is strong enough to be a concern.
Well, it's actually probably a concern now, because right now, machine intelligence is not going to evolve without humanity giving it some structure. So the concern is really with humanity and what we tell the machines to do.
Yeah, it's true. And what do we tell them to do? And what consciousness do we come from as the parents, so to speak?
Well, people didn't really consider cars to be our children.
No,
I mean,
because
although some people love them as much as their children.
Because they're classic tools. They're more in the tool category. They do what we say.
Right.
But we're talking about, like, you know, we were at that conference where we were talking about ambient intelligence, where the environment anticipates your every need. Mm-hmm. You know, where the everything around you becomes smarter. It's not just about robots being in bodies. It's about the intelligence being everywhere, in the walls.
Right.
The house. There have been science fiction stories about guys who have their spaceship where their wife who had passed on, they moved her persona into the nervous system of the spaceship. So he was surrounded by her all the time. That kind of thinking, those sorts of things are becoming real much more quickly than we anticipated.
The kind of world that people fantasize about so that they alleviate their loneliness by having access to some giant playback machine.
Well, it's not a playback. It's paying attention to your needs and wants every moment. And we naturally know how to ask for what we want. Our species has had this slave domination relationship for thousands of years, and we're using it to imbue those ideas into the machines so that they serve us well. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's what we expect our tools and machines to do, is to serve us well.
What about the issue that the robots might just take over, outsmart the humans? And, you know, it reminds me of the Forbin Project story where the robots forbade us to have any more wars.
Yeah, or the day the Earth stood still, where the robots basically kept the peace in the galaxy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think this is really the fundamental question, is when do we lose freedom by giving away our power to something else, whether it's robots, whether it's a crazy relationship with nature so that we can't survive on the planet anymore, and so we have to give up all our rights to just get fed. You know, there's all kinds of ways that we can be less free, even though we invent things to deal with our problems.
Well, the Promethean answer to that is to give control of the robots over to nature directly, not just have our species run them.
Uh-huh.
At that point, you know, if you want to let it out of control, you might as well go all the way and completely give our tool-making abilities to nature as a whole. That would be the most radical thing I could think of, anyway.
All right, folks, we are going to go to our little mid-hour break. Then we'll come back with more thoughts and articles about the nature of being human.
Oh, well, Greg says you'll be able to send your drone to work for you.
And you get to keep the paycheck, right?
The day the world shucked and jived.
All right, so stay tuned.
Thank you. Well, welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. We did get some comments on this, the whole robot, the rise of robots. There's another interesting story this week on that whole topic, just to keep it grounded in actual news stories here. AP has robot journalists now that are writing stories on a daily basis. According to The Verge, AP has been writing up to 3,000 stories every quarter written by machines. They said that minutes after Apple released its record-breaking quarterly earnings last week, the AP published a story on that where Apple tops the street 1Q forecasts. It's a story without a byline, or at least a human byline. It's a financial story, so it's got a lot of financial information in it, but it was published by an automated system that's well-versed in the AP style guide.
Hey, you know what? Some of our audience are calling in to talk about robots and overlords.
Okay. So just to say this, they say this new robot system generated by automated insights can produce 2,000 articles per second if need be.
Oh, boy, so it can write them faster than we can read them.
By far. There's no comparison.
Do we care?
You know, human intelligence is...
I tell you, we're lighting up the boards here. You want to hear what people have to say about this?
Yeah, let's bring...
All right, we'll start with RC and Aptos. Hey, RC, welcome to the Dr. Future Show.
Yeah, hey, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon, Dr. Future.
Yeah, good afternoon. So where do you stand on all this? What do you think?
Well, it's interesting. I wanted to quote, and who's the, now you guys may know this, who's the Japanese scientist, the go-to guy?
Michio Kaku.
Yeah. He's got the kind of shoulder-length silver hair.
He's a physicist, yeah.
Yes.
He was talking about robots, mm-hmm. and I believe he must have been talking about mobile robots, not computer type robots like Watson or...
Yeah, in Japan, they are specializing in robots that look like humans, and they're doing their best to make them aides that can work in hospitals and not spook people, you know?
They're into the android concept pretty heavily over there.
Yeah.
Well, this is his quote. Now, don't kill the messenger here.
Okay.
But I'll try to do an imitation of him.
Okay.
He said that the smartest robot that we have today is a smart... as a cockroach, but a retarded cockroach, a stupid cockroach.
Sounds about right.
So he doesn't have a lot of faith that we're anywhere near the Matrix type of robotics or Terminator type of robotics that maybe others...
Well, that's good to keep in mind in terms of overall intelligence.
I think we could have a debate about that because I think the weird thing about the robots is that we don't even recognize their intelligence and how they're already affecting our world. A couple of weeks ago, I remember I had just come across a TED Talk that was about how the AIs that run the stock market are sort of these computer algorithms that are at war. One computer algorithm is trying to hide the footprints of the big institutional investors so that it doesn't skew the market. And another set of AI robots are trying to discover the patterns so that they can figure out which investments to make. And so these two robots are both trying to figure out the trend in the marketplace so that they can buy and sell stocks faster than anything else. And because of the war of these two competing algorithms and all of the AI agents in the marketplace, mountains have been bulldozed between New York and Chicago just to create a conduit for the information so that trades can be made fractions of a second faster. So this is AI behavior. It's not human. It is creating a bulldozer digging lines through nature, you know?
Well, I guess I'm talking about the narrow context in between a supercomputer, which it sounds like you're describing, and a robot, a mobile robot, like we've seen in Terminator or something like that. We're nowhere near that
as far as
mobility goes.
But I do have full disclosure here.
I do believe in or follow the skeptic science.
Yeah.
I'm somebody who doesn't believe that aliens have ever visited our planet.
Uh-huh.
And I believe that Oswald acted alone. So, all right.
Yeah, that's fair enough. I'm glad you're here. You know, we need to keep a balance on this because it's easy to get lost in with fact from fiction and this stuff.
All right. Thanks for that, RC. And let's go to our next caller here. Okay. Hello, Dave from San Diego.
How's it going?
It's going good. How are you?
Oh, good.
So what's up?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I wanted to ask John Monahan a question.
Sure. John's here.
All right.
Yeah. Hey John.
Hello, Dave.
Chairman. Yeah. I wanted to find out, John. I heard that you used to be a robot and your girlfriend was Brigitte Bardot.
Is that truth to that, John?
What do you say,
yeah,
John?
I decided to go human.
Or did you have a Brigitte Bardot robot?
You do not look like a robot. You totally had me fooled. What is this? What are you talking about, Dave?
Oh, well, you know, I'm just trying to get some things straight because John's been telling me a few stories recently, and he told me that he used to work as a robot, and his girlfriend was Brigitte Bardot.
He's shaking his head here. I'm not sure you got the story right.
I was a limousine driver. That's almost like being a robot. But,
oh, yeah. Actually, in the future, the robots, probably the first robots that we're all going to have at home are going to be our limo drivers.
Well,
oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and the other thing is I also heard that that John used to be the bodyguard for Marilyn Monroe's robot, whose nickname was JFK.
Really?
Well, at least I've met JFK three times. I bet you nobody else in the county can claim that.
You mean John's been planted here to keep an eye on Dr. and Mrs. Future?
What are you asserting, Dave? Are you saying that John was a robot or is a robot?
I'm saying that he's a very creative guy, and as a result, when he wants to, he can be an impersonator.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, but not yet a robot, right?
Still? No. He's still very human, and he's in a protoplasmic form at this point.
Right.
But, yeah. Thanks for clarifying.
But one day he might have a robot to wipe his. Anyway, take care of him. Various ways. Yeah.
Well, all right, Dave. Well, thanks for that.
When I speak to the other robots, I'll have put in a good word for you, Dave.
Hey, thanks. I appreciate it.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for going.
Absolutely.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Gee, Dan.
See you next Thursday.
Yeah. Part of your fan club?
I tell you, we're learning more about John every day.
I know,
He's
right?
He's been in some mighty interesting situations in his life.
So back to the robots. Greg says sophisticated gambling. He thinks the robots will be getting good at that.
Uh-huh. Sophisticated gambling, right. Mm-hmm. Oh, you know, Diane Slattery wrote one of my very, very favorite books called The Maze Game.
Oh, yes.
And in that book, the star, one of the main lead characters, is an AI intelligence who is a hacked version of a gambling database, you know, of a gambling broker AI allows, you know, people to bet on horse races and stuff like that.
So there's something to this.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm reflecting on this idea that the current robots are only the intelligence of a cockroach. And that's an amazing number of jobs that they hold in our society for cockroaches, cockroach-level intelligences already.
Really? Which jobs are being held by robots?
An assembly line job. They're doing a lot of stuff, right? Uh-huh. They're
all over
driving
the Tesla
cars
factory.
And, you know, they're the autonomous vehicles. They're driving the airplanes. And for cockroaches, they're doing pretty good. Sure. You can imagine if they were smarter, jobs they would take over.
Oh, hey, look, let's maybe use this as a segue to this interesting article about Google and Uber.
Yeah, that's an interesting little battle going on over in the valley.
Yeah, all right. So if you think of robots as machines that are self-mobile, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they can look like humans, or they can be little Roomba vacuums, or they can be autonomous cars. But the main thing is that they're self-contained, mm-hmm. right? And so they can have robot personalities, and those can maybe be somewhat humanized. That's as opposed to the general AI, which is more like her, which is this internet distribution of data everywhere that's watching you and imitating some kind of communicating being that tells you what you want to know when you want to know it.
Right.
Okay,
yeah.
So that's not a robot, that's an AI.
That's an AI, yeah. It's easy to confuse the two, but because the two are intimately intertwined in a lot of ways. But the story that you mentioned...
You know, let's go to a break and then do the story.
Okay.
All right, folks, you're listening to the Dr. Future Show on KSCO. We'll be right back.
Hey, guys. Cougars here with your choice word for my recent
step. Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. Gee, we had two more robot stories in the news this week. One involves Uber and Google Ventures.
Okay, now Uber, for people, who
have Uber is the car service, for those that don't know, that it's giving you cheaper rates for getting cabs, basically.
Well, it's a shared cab service.
Right.
That allows drivers to drive their own cars for pay and get hired by an internet routing service.
Right. Now, Google Ventures, the search giant's venture capital arm, invested $258 million in Uber in August of 2013. Now, that was Google Ventures' largest investment ever. And the company put more money into Uber's next funding round less than a year later. Okay? So you would think that with all this money that Google's been pouring into Uber, that they would, like, maybe team more closely together or maybe even one day acquire it, right? But now it looks like there are signs that the companies are more likely to be ferocious competitors than allies.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. It's the millennials against the Xers.
You think?
Right? Yeah, I think so.
little different gangs.
Google's the Xers, Uber's the millennials. They don't want to play in the same
different gangs of competitive dudes here.
It's a generation gap, you mm-hmm. know? It's 10 years difference there.
Well, Google's preparing to offer its own ride-hailing service, most likely in conjunction with their driverless car project, which we all know about.
Oh, so they're not just going to give it to Uber, huh? They're not going to merge forces. They're going to do their own?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and apparently there has been an app that has been spotted out in the wild, screenshots of what appears to be a Google ride-sharing app that's currently being used by Google employees.
Mm-hmm.
And then this came out from a person who requested not to be named. And they're sort of looking at what this all means. Uber is also apparently teaming up with Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. Now, Carnegie Mellon is famous for its own autonomous vehicle technology, and that's one of the robot centers of research in mm-hmm. the country, Carnegie Mellon.
Mm-hmm.
So does that mean Uber's going separate ways from Google on the same track, autonomous vehicle ride service?
So the robot cars used to be friends, and they're becoming estranged.
Yes.
Just like being a chauffeur, you know.
Yeah, you should know about
this.
You've
got a lot to say about this, don't you?
Yeah. But the new robots coming in for driving cars.
Yeah, turn right here, you know.
So if you were still driving a car, how would you feel about the Uber service and the automated driving cars of Google?
You know, some cars have, believe it or not, video TVs on the dashboard in the front of the car, which should be illegal. But if I could turn the driving over to a robot, I could watch TV while I'm driving.
So if you were driving today, you'd look forward to the automation, to the automatic
yeah, right.
Like qualities of the driver.
Watch the game or something.
Car. Yeah, watch the game. Yeah.
Great. So maybe what we need, all right, we know that there's a threat that the robots are going to take over the human jobs. Now, what if we made it that any time that a robot is doing a job, basically a human has to get paid? So every robot job, the paycheck goes to a human, and then we can all live in the, what did the hackers used to call it? The leisure economy? What was it called?
Yeah, the rise of the hacker leisure class.
That's it. Yes, the hacker leisure class. Maybe we can have the robot leisure class. Right?
Well, that's the idea that if the people who own the robots are the workers, the people, then that could make a big difference.
Capitalism is supposed to be about owning the means of production.
Yeah.
So maybe capitalism just transitions to capitalism means owning your own wage-earning robot.
Could be. I mean, it's certainly one of the potential answers. But the thing is that the automation is going to be everywhere. You know, it's not just going to be in the robots. You know, mm-hmm. So the intelligence is happening everywhere. It might require a new kind of economy itself for this to work out.
Yeah, well, I think we really have to retire the idea that the medieval system of accounting that we're currently using for our economy has anything to offer the new computerized economy. We really need a whole different...
Yeah, there's new kinds of money coming in. Cryptocurrency promises to deliver along those lines.
Oh, yeah, let's jump to that article about the new money.
Well, before that, I want to get into this other one. This is really interesting. Research in virtual reality at Stanford has shown that humans are able to master other bodies besides the human body. They've developed a body that has a third arm, for example. A third arm. And they have found, this is one of the pioneers,
now,
Jaron Lanier.
Is a virtual body that they're mastering? That has
a
third
you're
arm?
In a virtual space.
It's not a robot.
No, well, it's a body that you control in virtual space.
A lot of robots, a lot of quarterbacks could use a third arm.
Yeah, in this reality, it could be handy, right? It's called homuncular flexibility.
Uh-huh.
Homuncular flexibility.
Okay, so how do you control this third arm? Winking? I mean,
they've been experimenting with what they call a gesture language. you know, where you move your hands a certain way and it causes something to the body to move in the other space.
So you so flap motion your wings space, and yeah. you have a virtual avatar that
responds
raises three arms.
Accordingly, yeah. Mm-hmm. And they've been experimenting with different things. They were trying crawling. They had a crawling creature so you could wiggle like a caterpillar. And they found that people could do that. It's remarkable how humans are capable of imagining themselves in other bodies. It's been very, very successful. And they
so
found
really,
that
you're just, as a human, you're going to be in some kind of a gestural dance, and there's going to be a connection with what you're doing with something that isn't at all human like you are on the screen.
So or in the virtual space.
It's a new mapping of the way you move with the way your virtual characters move.
Yeah, yeah. They did some experiments on it. They had, in the first experiment, they asked 53 undergrads at Stanford to pop balloons by kicking and punching in a virtual classroom. Uh-huh. And they had each person wear motion tracking bracelets around their ankles and their wrists. And that controlled the avatar's appendages and a first-person virtual headset so they could watch their movements. And one group had regular moving limbs, but the others controlled their hands with their feet and vice versa.
Right.
And people preferred using their arms. They popped nearly 300 balloons in 10 minutes. But they found that the subjects adapted to the switch condition and they were able to pop as many balloons when their feet controlled their avatar's hands. So you could pop balloons with your feet as well as your hands. But people generally tended to prefer their hands. They found that if you could control like both of them, you could pop even more balloons.
Right.
And they went for that.
Well,
they found that a third arm sprouted from the chest that moved forwards or sideways with a flick of your wrist worked well. So you could control a third arm from your chest. That seemed
for popping research. Balloons in a virtual world.
Yeah, for popping balloons.
I tell you, people have too much time on their hands. They really do.
Well, it's important to figure out where you wanted a third appendage. I mean, you could have gone for the tail, right? I mean, you don't need to think of your chest as, but that's what they found. Research is valuable.
Absolutely.
You know?
Well, you know, I have to say that virtual games are fun. I remember one of my very favorite things from Burning Man was the Dance Dance Immolation game.
Yeah,
right?
that was pretty.
And there's a lot of people who like that kind of like look at a screen, follow the dots on the screen and, you know, jump up and down and sort of do your little hopscotch thing. So
yeah.
We do continue to invent new things for humans to do with their bodies that integrate the screen type inventions.
Yeah, by the way, in Dance Dance Immolation, if you didn't get the dance move right, you got blasted with this giant ball of flame.
Right.
But you were contained within a special protection suit.
Yeah, you had to wear your flame retardant suit.
But you had to learn how to dance.
From this.
It was a little awkward. It's kind of like trying to dance in a spacesuit.
Exactly. But you know, what a great workout.
Yeah, right.
Anyway.
So they say that, you know, we can get used to this. And if you're a fanatic gamer, you'll get very used to long-term exposure to altered bodies. And it does reprogram your sensation of yourself, which is interesting. They say like a real life analogy is like an ice skating where you hop off the ice and you walk a few feet and your legs feel real heavy. It doesn't quite work after you leave the ice. That's a motor reprogramming of human perception right there that happens when we wear ice skates.
Well, you know, we went to that lecture at UC Santa Cruz this last week on neuroplasticity.
Neuroplasticity, right.
And my takeaway related to the subject from that is that the brain is extremely flexible and can be remapped. But your networks of behavior, your neural network, are formed very much like muscles. The more you use them, the more substance there is to use. And once you've set up a network of behavior, like the way your brain works a certain way, a part of it is for listening, a part of it is for using your eyes, a part of it is for moving your arms. It's a big deal to remap it if you lose that.
Well, that's, I find it's very useful for people with phantom limb pains and that sort of thing to begin to rechannel those impressions into a robotic body.
Right. Yeah, but it is very positive for, say, retraining people after a stroke to realize that
the plasticity is there.
The brain does have the ability to reuse those circuits in new ways. You just have to retrain it.
Right.
That's a new way of thinking about
right.
it.
Right. They did find the training is really important. Certain trainings work really well. Some don't. They found with the third arm is that it took 2.5 minutes to learn to snatch more boxes with three arms. You know, so that was good. But it required it being presented in a way that was intuitive to the user. not some complicated thing that they did had to try to figure out.
Right.
Anyway, this work is going on at the Stanford's Virtual Human Interaction Lab, and we have a link to you at our website. And it ties in with this whole debate on the robots, and you know, it's you know, this whole idea of us versus them just doesn't work anymore. You know, there's not a separation. It's like, are we, you know, like race car drivers, pilots all feel like they become one with their machine? Well, it's because they are. It is an extension of your being, and it will continue to be in more and more forms as we develop the ability to interface with our tools more.
All right. You know, we're just at the top of the hour. We're going to jump from what is it to be human to what is it to be erotic?
Yeah, from Humans 2.0 to what is erotic now?
So stay tuned, folks. The second hour is going to be one of our classic annual favorites. What is erotic is in the house, and we're going to be interviewing them and
finding out about this year's show and how it's going to stimulate us.
That's right.
Interesting new ways.
And I would go to some music if I could.
Da, 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 da.
All right. We'll be back.